Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Does an executive leader need to drink the company Kool-Aid and believe the PR spin in order to lead? And what if you don't? What if your core values are severely tested by your organisation's actions? Or if you're a bureaucrat, by your government's policies? Well, if you're Trish Bergen, you dig deep, really deep, into your toolkit of exceptional leadership skills.
Feminism, by definition, is the belief that men and women should have equal rights and opportunities.
Feminism is about equality, isn't it? It's about men and women having the same opportunities in life.
If that does not suit you, then get out.
There's been a lot of talk recently about whether our country is ready for women leaders.
It takes courage and strength to be empathetic.
Smashing the glass ceiling yet again!
Not now, not ever.
I moved on her like a bitch.
I just don't think there's a place for sexism in our politics.
Nobody respects women more than Donald Trump.
This has to stop.
Hello and welcome to Broad Talk, the podcast about women, power and the wayward world. I'm Virginia Hausiger. This is episode 6 of our series looking at new leadership, a style of feminised leadership that we've seen highlighted during the coronavirus crisis in stark contrast to the struggles of the world's strongman leaders. In a moment, I'll introduce you to the extraordinary story of Trish Bergen. But first, I just want to say thanks to you. Thanks for joining me in this podcast journey. I really hope you're enjoying the series, and I'd love to hear from you as to what or who you've enjoyed listening to most and why. The best way to connect with us on Broad Talk is to take a virtual seat at our Broad Talk round table on Facebook. We've had some great discussions in that Facebook group on the topics we've covered and the ones you want to hear about. So join the gang on Facebook to connect with me and your fellow listeners. You can find us there as Broad Talk, all one word. And don't forget to hit subscribe on your favourite pod platform so you don't miss an episode. And while you're there, if you're feeling encouraging and warm, please leave us a review because that really helps us get the word out about this series. Now, let me introduce Trish Bergen. Trish's expertise as an economist saw her rise to prominence early. As a new mother, she flew to Washington, D.C. to become the first woman to head up the Department of Finance office at the Australian Embassy. With a talent for behavioural economics, she went on to forge a stellar career with numerous leadership positions in both the public and private sector. And a disclaimer here, I've known Trish for some time. In fact, I interviewed her for her current job as director at the 50-50 by 2030 Foundation, which I founded at the University of Canberra. From the moment she was appointed head of the Office for Women in the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet back in 2017, I'd had my eye on Trish because of her reputation as a fantastic leader, a gender equality advocate, a super smart bureaucrat, and a lovely person to boot. But as you'll hear in this episode of Broad Talk, Trish has a pretty amazing backstory, which I didn't know about at all. So this discussion actually gets quite personal at times as she opens up about the poverty she experienced as a child. But perhaps most revealing is how Trish handled the crushing experience of being forced to defend the indefensible, including government failures on gender equality. As a woman who's strongly values-driven, Trish's rich experience has forced her to think long and hard about the role and responsibility of leaders and the power of influence. It's a delight to be joined today by Trish Bergen. Trish, welcome.
Welcome. Hi.
It's lovely to have you here. Trish, I want to jump straight into the issue of leadership. And this is something I know that you and I have talked about many, many times in various formats. But before I do, I also want to just get some clarity around what do you think leadership is?
Oh, such a big question, and one I think when you ponder it on a, I don't know, daily, weekly, annual basis, you tend to...
As we do.
There are many facets to leadership. But to me, when you boil it all down, it really comes down to basically leadership is about change and facilitating change. It's about having a vision for what needs to be done. Sometimes it's not a palatable thing that needs to be done, but it needs to be done, and you can tell that the broader good is served by it, either within an office, a team, an organisation, or at a national or community level. It's having that vision for change and for reform to make things better. And I guess the elements that really strike me when I think about good leaders and great leaders are those that think about that leadership function in terms of being able to describe that vision, what's needed to get there, is able to listen, to really listen to advice, take advice, bring the right people together, and to make decisions in a timely fashion. But then it's also about the whole emotional intelligence side too. And that's understanding that we as human beings don't really like change, even when change can be, objectively in our favour or a good thing for the future. Just changing and disrupting our patterns as we on a day-to-day basis can really annoy us. So,
well, it's almost like sometimes we've got a bit of a default mechanism within us as human beings that in fact we resist change,
don't
we?
Oh, we do, absolutely. There are many, many studies into human nature that just show that we don't like it. We don't like change. And, you can see it at every level from a new road that's going to save time and improve flow of traffic and things like that will necessarily have some disruption. And often people just resist and say, nope, we don't want that road because it's just going to be changed. And I think that's the case at significant national policy levels as well. People really look at things and say, yes, we want a better society, we want a fairer society, a more equal society, but getting there, the road to getting there and the pathway that might involve some wins and some losses for each of us seen as being really, too big a hurdle to cross. So that's the leader's job.
We were both listening to the trailer for a film recently that was run in the Sydney Film Festival on leadership, where one of the main players actually made a really good point when she said, leadership is easy when things are good. The ultimate test is, can you do it effectively when things aren't good?
Oh, absolutely.
And that reminded me, and it reminded me personally of how easy it is when, despite being in a leadership position where people are looking at you for guidance, when the going gets really tough, sometimes I've just thought, nah, I'm out of here. It's too hard. I don't want to do this. It's hard. It's really hard to sort of gee yourself up. You've no doubt, in fact, I'm sure in your extraordinary leadership career, you've had that experience a number of times. What's pushed you forward when you really wanted to say, okay, I don't need this, I'm going?
Oh, gosh. I think it's that absolute adherence to the goal that you're trying to achieve. It's really that strong commitment that if not you, who? I often remember in some of my first leadership roles where, you know, you have to have lots of tough conversations as a leader. You have to have conversations with external stakeholders. You have to have tough conversations with staff sometimes, team members, even your boss. Sometimes you have to have some really tough conversations. And I had some really good advice that someone gave me very early on that said, once you're pretty much a leader of a big team, then if it's not you, then who is going to be, you know, sticking to that, either the values of an organisation, you know, the points at which you won't go past them, or whether it's just absolutely being committed that something that is tough is difficult to do, but it has to be done, and you just have to give it your all. But I do know what you mean about it. It can be an incredibly lonely experience sometimes, when even sometimes your loyal team members look at you and think, you know, surely aren't we done? This isn't going to work.
Mm.
And you have to be the one that says, come on, once more into the breach.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that point of loneliness. I must say, as a long-time observer of politics from the position of a journalist and politically, particularly close to politics, I have often had a sense that those at the highest level of leadership often are pretty lonely people.
Absolutely.
And I sometimes wonder, is it necessary to hold yourself a little bit, not above, but aside from others? Is loneliness part of leadership?
Yes, I think it is sometimes part of leadership, because there are going to be times, I think, when you, especially when you're not in the wonderful position that I'm in, being co-director with the wonderful Kim Rubenstein. When you are the leader, there are times when you are the only one that can continue a course of action and make decisions. And it might be a decision to stop or change track. And there'll be a lot of people, even within your organisation, that will say to you, no, that's not the right thing to do. And you listen. But there are times when you just have to say, no, I'm sorry, we are going this way. And that's, I think, for me, those have been the loneliest times where almost everybody has said, I'll give up, or no, don't go that way, or just keep it the way it is. And, you know, that's where you have to have long walks and chats to mentors about, you know, am I mad? But
why am I doing this?
Why am I doing this?
I must admit, I have thought that a number of times, and I've interviewed various senior people, particularly in the Australian Public Service, actually, when they've told me some pretty horrible stories about the loneliness that they've experienced. One in particular, and I obviously won't name who the person is, but they told me that they would arrive at work, park in their privileged car park spot, and sit gripping the steering wheel for several minutes before getting out of the car each morning to sort of brace themselves before they went inside. And this was during a particularly difficult period when there was some major, major policy work going on. And I remember thinking, why would you do that? Why not just stay home and grow the roses? I mean, really? But, yeah, look, is it something that just infects some people more than others? I mean, you yourself have had a very, very strong and solid career through both public service and private enterprise, but you've taken up a number of leadership positions and some pretty jolly tough ones too, might I add. I mean, do you think that it is something about you yourself, your own personality, that has made you hang in there and want to take on these leadership roles?
Oh, definitely. I've thought long and hard about this. As you say, sometimes I think, why wasn't I just happy to, I don't know, do something that really isn't in the cut and thrust of policy or even in business or, you know, a lot of those sorts of areas. And I think there is something in us that is drawn to drawn to tough gigs, I think, or challenging gigs. They don't necessarily have to be super tough, but or tough in and of themselves, but challenging. You want something that you will be able to stand back from and feel like, oh, I've done that. I've put a brick in that wall. I've made that better. And yeah, I think it's from days when I was in the public service the first time around, and I decided I wanted to go to the Department of Finance, and everybody said, you're mad, they work, ridiculous hours over the budget, it's crazy, it's a very male-dominated area, goodness me. But it was somewhere that I wanted to go because I wanted to experience that that cut and thrust and the real, I suppose, yeah, I guess I was drawn to how power was used and how to use that effectively in the pursuit of policy goals, which, yeah, but there was an innate drive.
I want to understand that innate drive a little bit, and we'll come back to your role, particularly with the Department of Finance, particularly when you were representing Australia in Washington. But let's just unpack that a little bit. Going back to your early years, I'm interested to know what your life was like as a kid growing up, young Trish, and what it was that kind of stung you about achieving and fed you with the arrow of ambition. What do you think it was?
I would put it down to my upbringing. I had a single mother. My grandmother lived with us. We left my father in Brisbane literally in the middle of, middle of the afternoon when he was at the pub, filled everything we could get into my grandmother's 1959 VW and headed off out of Brisbane.
Why were you doing that? Why?
Because that was before no fault divorce and all of that sort of thing. So there was no other way she could leave him, and he was a terrible alcoholic. We were dirt poor because he drank and didn't work, and she worked as much as she could, but in those days didn't earn much at all as a young secretary. And so, yeah, she just said, I just can't do this anymore. So she and my grandmother packed myself and my sister and a dog into this car, and we just took off. And basically,
Trish, how old were you then?
Six.
Yep. 6 years old.
Yeah.
That must have been pretty frightening time, wasn't it?
Yes and no. I mean, life at home had been incredibly, not non-traditional in a lot of ways, just because of whom, my father's condition. So very unpredictable, I would say. So jumping in the car, and my grandmother had always told me, I was very close to my grandmother. She had always told me, Ducky, when my ship comes in, we're going to Sydney. So, so I thought, ducky. So that was kind of, I think, what the plan was. We just headed south. They didn't know where they were going, so we basically just headed south.
Wow.
It was amazing. So finally, yeah.
How do you think that uncertainty though informed what you then went on and did in life, and just the choices you made? Did it make you determined to develop your own security?
Yes, absolutely. And when we finally arrived in Canberra, my mum and my gran got, three jobs each, equally, literally. My mother worked here at the ANU actually for quite a long time. And my grandmother worked as a bookkeeper, took in ironing. My mother worked at the after hours at the Dixon Library. We worked. We were a family that worked. So work and, achievement went hand in hand. The other thing, and this is why I think my mother was so influential, she had only ever done up to year 10, the equivalent of year 10 when she finished school, and she took herself back and did her HSC, and then she studied part-time here at ANU and did a degree in political science, and topped every unit that she did. So that was one really big thing. I can still remember one day saying to her, oh, I'm not so sure I want to go to uni. You know, maybe I'll just, you know, get married and have kids. And she rarely got angry with me, but this time she just went white and said, let me tell you, you are going to university. And, you know, and it's about security. So, yeah.
Did that kind of background, though, make you feel that you needed to build your own security into your life?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's one of those key things, I think. And it's partly, I suppose, why I look at leadership. It is, you know, maybe it is a bit of control freak, but it is that thing about if you want something, then you have to be absolutely prepared to model it yourself and do it yourself to lead others. But you know, that's where the greater sense of, yeah, security comes from, I'd say.
Trish, I heard you say once in a conversation that I was part of that was talking about, in very general terms, about privilege and entitlement and opportunity. And I was really surprised to hear you say that you were the product of equal opportunity or equal opportunities.
Mm.
What did you mean?
I guess that was a number of ones. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to go to university if it hadn't been for the free education of the Whitlam era. So thank you. I thank Gough Whitlam every day. So that was you know, an opportunity. But in terms of equal opportunity by gender, I had some pretty fantastic mentors early on in the public service who really took gender equality seriously. And that was important, particularly being in the sort of economics profession, being in government, in finance portfolio, or before that employment portfolio. And those, you know, there weren't many women in leadership positions in those organisations. And it was through the support from a number of secretaries of those departments where they really fostered a sense of we need to make a change here. And this is going back to the early 80s, mid 80s and so on. And, you know, the amount of organisational support that I got, particularly as a very young SES officer, senior executive service officer, when I was in my early 30s, I had young children, and, I got a lot of assistance to be an SES officer in Department of Finance with young children, as in three under five. So...
Wow.
Yeah. So it was terrific. So there are some real highlights in terms of, I think, how I've been given some real gifts, I think.
Mm. Well, gifts and opportunities, but also, you know, my goodness me, haven't you honoured that by the work that you're doing now and working so hard at policy reform to support other women? But before we even get onto that, just coming back to your earlier work, when, for example, you were the head of the Department of Finance office at the Australian Embassy in Washington, you had to represent Australia on a number of occasions. At what point did you find yourself feeling that you were comfortable doing that sort of work and in fact taking on that leadership kind of role? Did it happen gradually, or did you have to talk yourself into it? How did it work?
It's pretty much once you arrive in Washington, then you pick up the mantle from the person who had been there before. And they'd never had a woman in the job until I went there. And so it was bizarre, because most of the appointments that were in my diary when I first arrived there, and they said, oh, well, you've got to meet, you know, so-and-so from the Brookings Institute, and they're going to take you through what the conference the following week will be about. But, oh, it's at this club downtown and all this sort of thing. And very, very much the very masculine, blokey club type of way of engaging with a lot of the stakeholders that I had to engage with. So I had to just kind of delicately dismantle that environment so that I could actually
do that?
I would just say, I have young children, I have to go home. So It was about making coffee dates, doing things like that instead of long boozy lunches, and because I'm just not into that.
but Trish, did you ever feel though that that might be disadvantaging
you
because
absolutely.
you were asking them to do it, to behave differently too, effectively in the engagement?
That's right. It did.
Well, did it worry you that you might actually somehow, you know, lose that position or be talked down because you wanted to do it differently?
Oh, goodness, yes, absolutely. I got lots of gratuitous advice from older men in the embassy that, I'd really have to kind of play the game properly. Otherwise, I wasn't going to be effective. And I couldn't. There was no way I could do that.
But did it worry you that you might actually jeopardising your position?
Enormously. But, you know, again, that was just not something I would countenance. I couldn't operate that way, so I certainly didn't want to start that way.
Did you have a partner back at the house?
Oh, yes, I did.
Could actually take on the role of being primary carer?
Yes, it was very interesting, though, because my husband at the time was had been a CEO with a lobbying group here in Canberra, and so he'd resigned to come to Washington. So for the first 6 to 8 months, it was pretty torrid for him. He felt like he'd kind of, as he used to say, slid off the wall and didn't quite know where to put himself. So it was important, I think, to share in parenting, even though I was going out to work every day and he was staying home minding the kids and doing the school run, which he did a brilliant job of. I think it was important that I didn't go the whole hog and you know, go out for lots of dinners and do all those sorts of things too. But it's just not my style. It's really not my style. I think that's fundamentally the reason I didn't do that. But it did worry me because I got so much advice, as I say, that this was just critical. But I turned it around, actually. And
Did. I mean, you obviously, you did turn it around because you just continued to go from success to success. So, you know, it didn't do you a damage that you insisted on doing it differently.
Yeah.
Which is a leadership lesson in itself, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
You're listening to Trish Bergen speaking with me, Virginia Hausiger, on Broad Talk. And this is our first series on leadership. It's all about leaders, by leaders and for leaders. And we're just going to take a short break and be back in a moment.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Now, Trish, moving on to, and I'm leaping right forward here, but when you were the head of the Office for Women in the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, which is when you first came to my attention, because I had just set up the 50-50 by 2030 Foundation, and I was very eager to engage with you and to work in partnership with the Office for Women. And I know that you did some really tough work during that period. It was pretty difficult. The office itself, wasn't necessarily supported as much as it should have been from government or the Prime Minister or Prime Ministers at the time. And I know there was a time when Australia was under or copping quite a bit of flack over its performance in international treaties around gender equality, etc., and our rankings in the global gender rankings were falling, and mind you, continue to fall. But you had to at one point represent Australia in Geneva at one of those really tough UN hearings. It was the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW as we call it, and you had to represent Australia and answer some really, really tough questions about why Australia was performing badly. And I remember as a journalist, I was just out of journalism at the time, but as a journalist with my journalist radar on, watching this and listening and thinking, oh my gosh, that's really awful. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you coped?
I'm still in trauma counselling, but I wasn't mad.
I'm not surprised.
Goodness, that it was like Senate estimates on steroids, and it was 6.5 hours of being questioned through an interpreter by a room full of committee members who come from all over the from all the 193 UN countries. Not 193 of them, but from the whole membership. They fire about 10 to 15 questions to you at the one time. I had a team of a delegation of 12 people that we were using WhatsApp on our iPads to say, okay, you know, Prue, you take this, Jim, you take that, Chantelle, you take that. So it was extraordinary, I think the event itself, but in terms of the actual facing the committee was very hostile towards Australia. Australia had not appeared at its regular briefing 4 years before, so it was 8 years between our appearances, and our report the previous period had been 2 years late. So I was determined that we would get our report in on time and that we would attend and, you know, give a good account of ourselves. And essentially,
Trish, can I just jump in there though? But I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but my memory of it at the time was that the CEDAW committee had good reason to be tough on Australia for those lateness reasons, but also that Australia wasn't performing well.
Absolutely.
And really had no good reason, no good explanation as to why, other than politics. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. And the entire if you boiled down all of the questions, they came down to how is it that a country as rich as Australia, as peaceful as Australia, is doing so very poorly in terms of gender equality and reducing discrimination against women. And literally that's what, if you took every question, that's really where it came down to. And in particular the intersectional, sort of where we'd fallen down with women with a disability, and certainly our record with our Indigenous First Nations women, their record in terms of higher incarceration rates, obviously poverty, health, poorer health outcomes, you name it. Really that was the thing they could not understand, and so they would look for things and say, well, why is it that the Australia, I think that was just after Australia had signed some significant deals in terms of military weaponry and so on, and they said, how is it that Australia's become the 10th largest arms dealer, but yet it has this record in terms of gender equality across all of those intersections?
So it was grueling, it was a grilling, and you had to, in representing Australia and therefore obviously representing the Australian government, you had to come up with some decent responses, which I'm guessing in your heart of hearts you didn't feel particularly good about. How do you do that?
Oh, look, it is such a thin line, I think, that you have to tread, because I would not say something that was not true. However, as a professional public servant, you support the government of the day. And so the way, I guess, and, you know, certainly anybody who's experienced Senate estimates would know that a lot of the time the only answer can be that's government policy. And in terms of them asking, you know, did I agree with that, it's not for me to say. As a professional public servant, it is not for me to say. It's about how you can point to where you are trying to shift the dial and where efforts are being made. But at the end of the day, sometimes it is simply saying that is government policy. That is up to the elected officials of the day. It's not up to me as a public servant I don't have the ability to decide that.
Now, that's really tough, and I guess this is where you really have to wear your leadership hat very tall, I suppose.
Yes.
And it tests your leadership capabilities, I guess, too. Did you come away from that having second thoughts about your leadership role, or was it just a matter of, look, I've got to dust myself off and get back up and get on with it?
I think it certainly it did have quite an effect on me, and probably resulted in me deciding before the last election that I needed to find a role where I could actually use my own voice. It is incredibly important in those leadership roles to be a truly good leader in those organisations where you have difficult policy and difficult. It's just a tough area when it doesn't accord with your ideas of what is good policy. It's important that you stay both authentic in the sense that you always look to be a professional public servant first, but you recognise that there are times when you're doing things that are not necessarily what you would choose to do. You have to be really clear with your team that first and foremost we are there to serve the government of the day, because if you start to I don't know, be very critical of the government, say, behind, you know, to your team, you really make it hard for people to actually do their best work, because you're sending them such mixed messages. So you have to be all about being absolutely professional. So I think that's the way I worked in that environment, successfully to drive reform in the office and improve our policy reach, our evidence, our ability to use data and analysis to support argument, and it was really about doing that well. Rather than judging ourselves by the policy outcome.
Trish, you mentioned there the ability to have your own voice, and it's absolutely fantastic to see you in the role that you're in now as co-director of the 50-50 by 2030 Foundation, and you share that position with Professor Kim Rubenstein. And the two of you are very, very different people, clearly, but you share it so beautifully. And speaking of voice, it was just wonderful to see how both of you responded to when the global pandemic hit, and it became pretty clear that the impact on women was not just profound, but being overlooked by the Australian government. Both you and Kim penned an op-ed for Broad Agenda, which I am chief editor for, so disclaimer there, but it was also run in the Canberra Times and got quite a big traction through mainstream media. But you penned a really interesting piece saying that leadership during crisis must be 50-50, and you pulled no punches in getting stuck into the government for its lack of gender diversity and gender equality in leadership positions. Did that feel like a bold thing to do?
Oh, yes, it did.
She says with relish.
but incredibly, incredibly liberating in the sense that I think it's so important to be able to point out some of these gaps, these massive gaps that are obvious in terms of the leadership voices that are at the table, because you know during the early stages of the pandemic, some of the decisions that were being made were just extraordinary, and some of them have been absolutely wonderfully extraordinary, like the decision to move to free childcare. So those sorts of things have been amazing, but there've also been some really odd decisions, most recently, in particular, the very first industry to have assistance rolled back from the assistance provided during the pandemic has been the childcare industry, which just I don't understand at all. But it does feel good to have a voice, and I think it's important to feel, to be a force for change. And coming back to our very the early part of our discussion, it's what drives me. It's wanting to make a difference in the direction that I think is important. I think childcare is an area that is a bit of a policy battlefield for the government at the moment, and I don't think it's really sorted out its views in terms of whether it should be just about childcare, i.e., what happens to children when parents go to work, or is it that, but it's also about early learning and the investment that we're making in our future population.
Trish, I'm going to just broaden our discussion out a little bit to a global view of the pandemic, in particular at leadership. It's been fascinating to watch how globally media around the world, particularly some of the big mainstream media mastheads, have got very excited about women's leadership, and there's been headline after headline about female leaders being so much more successful in handling COVID-19 than the strong men, and we all know who they are. But it's fascinating too, because there are only 13 nations in the world that are headed up by women, and at least 8 of them are constantly being nominated as among the best in the world for the way they've handled the pandemic. And, you know, Germany being a standout, New Zealand's Jacinda Ardern, of course, being a great standout, and Taiwan, Norway, Iceland, Finland, Norway and Denmark. Now, it's interesting from an Australian perspective, looking out and seeing this happen, and the gushingness we hear, particularly about Jacinda Ardern and her style of leadership. Does this make you feel that there is a new leadership, or at least an appreciation of a new leadership beginning to emerge more broadly?
Well, I guess I'm always an optimist, so I would love to think that is the case. I really do feel that it's not just one or two, and the fact, as you say, as you point out, that including a lot of the Nordic female leaders too, and as you say, Taiwan, that these leaders are not just the singular one person. Oh, that's just that person. It's starting to get to have a bit of a momentum, I guess, because it's not just one or two people, it's more than that. So I am hopeful that this is indicating a much a bit of a shift towards a more feminine style of leadership, or a leadership style that includes.
Is it a feminine style though? That's an interesting way of describing it.
Yeah, I was just hearing myself say that and thinking to myself, what do I mean by that? But I guess it's bringing some of those attributes that Well, I'll give you an example. Years and years ago, I, as an early leader in the public, in the Australian Public Service, working in, as I said, Department of Finance, I was told by my boss. He said, "Oh, you're just too nice. You're just too nice. You go and talk to people. You, you know, you listen to them, and you know, you go back to them, and all that sort of thing." And he said, "You just got
to never make a leader. Yeah, you're way
that's
too
right,
nice.
Exactly. Way too nice." And literally, that was my performance feedback. Was you're way too nice. And yet I could point to the difficult conversations I'd had with staff about performance and moved them on, done all sorts of things. And I think the feminine style of leadership is when I think of that, it's bringing a more collaborative tone, a way of working through issues, a way of bringing a bit more humanity to the discussion and understanding of the whole person that you're dealing with, rather than just a staff member, or in the case of Jacinda Ardern, the way she talks to people in, you know, on her Facebook, her it's almost like she's tucking the nation into bed. and I don't mean that in a I know that could sound I don't know what it could sound, but it sounds a bit soppy or something, but it really is quite personal, and that comes back to what I think really good leadership is. It's a social construct. It's a social activity. It happens between people. It can't just happen in terms of dollars and cents and things like that. It has to be set in the context of I understand you. And I want you to understand me and where I'm coming from.
It's interesting that you mentioned the dollars and cents there, because, I mean, of course, you're an economist, so you sort of come from that background. But one of the things that's been said during this pandemic and the Australian government's response is that by women is that the focus has been so much on the economy and the bottom line response. And whilst, of course, that is, you know, incredibly pivotal to, you know, whether or not Australia pulls out of this, okay. It's the other side of the impact, the human side, the personal emotional costs, the nervousness and anxiety that people are experiencing, sometimes without even knowing that they are. That has been kind of glossed over or missed
missing.
Somehow in our national response. And it's very interesting that Helen Clark, the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, has said about some of this sort of so-called new leadership that's emerging among women leaders, and particularly Jacinda Ardern in her own country. Helen Clark says that, you know, what really differentiates these women is that firstly and foremost, they're putting empathy right out front, and the health and human security of their citizens first and foremost, and treating that before they're treating the nation as, you know, an economic unit as such. And I thought that was really quite true, because we're all a bit tired of being treated as just economic units.
That's
and
right.
Not actual human beings.
My goodness, yes. I always remember after he'd been president, Barack Obama saying that one of the roles of the president of the United States, particularly in a time of crisis, is to be the human comforter, to be that chief comforter, I think he called himself, or called the role. And that ability to empathise, to go out and empathise with people in their suffering, and not treat them, as you say, as an economic unit that's not working or has lost their job or their house or whatever it is, but actually to help hold the nation's emotional response and help people to feel safe emotionally.
Yeah, and to display, you know, a human response. I've got to say, I became a little bit obsessed with watching Jacinda Ardern's Facebook posts, you know, sometimes quite late at night after she'd put her little toddler to bed. And there was one where I just thought it was so gorgeous. She was sitting in a room and she was talking, and she basically sort of got on Facebook and did this sort of live streaming chat where she was speaking to whoever was there and said, "Look, I just want to check in with you all." And it was like Well, for me, it felt like, you know, watching your sister sort of saying, oh, I'm just ringing up to see how you're going. It was a bit like that. But what was really lovely was she started getting questions fed in, and people were saying to her, oh, you look really tired. And she said, yeah, I probably am really tired. But then she said, but the lighting in this room is not very good. And then she started swinging her phone around to show everyone the room. And they said, oh, take a look at this lounge suite. It's really, really cool. And it was an old cane lounge suite, the sort of thing that, I don't know, my parents used to have in their 70s. And she said, take a look at this chair. I just love this chair. And I just thought, how very real is that? Here we are in the middle of a global crisis, basically a country lockdown. And she's responding to that, and she's, you know, anxious about it just like everyone else. But she was still able to say, oh, have a look at this chair. It's really cool. You know, I really love this chair. It was just so real. And I just thought, gosh, it's so... In many respects, it's so refreshing to see a leader who can both lead and be tough and rigorous, but also be really unafraid to be real and show herself. Yeah. It's just so unusual, isn't it?
It is, and I think that is the absolute essence of leadership is that humanness, the ability to display the fact that you're human, you know, and that goes for making mistakes, and we all make mistakes, and, you know, fessing up to people, and literally the power of standing in front of, let me tell you, power of standing in front of a group of people and saying that you're leading for and you're responsible for and saying, I messed up or I didn't see that coming or whatever it might be. It just really gives you, I suppose, authenticity in others' eyes, because you are genuinely, you're not hiding from your mistakes. You're not trying to shift them to others. You're a human being, and you can say, look, I did all of these things for that reason, but clearly I didn't have all the information or I hadn't got all the information. And it just... It's quite binding in the sense of not binding. It's unifying in the sense that it allows people to see themselves in you, and as long as you're not doing it every second day, but you know, carrying the can, and particularly carrying the can for the organisation publicly or up the line or whatever is absolutely critical.
And that sort of very authentic honesty too is something that I think, you know, a lot of leaders fail to understand. Citizens, the public, an audience, I say this as a, you know, a former television broadcaster over many decades, people can be very forgiving if you are honest.
I agree.
You know, if you do fess up, they can be very forgiving, very understanding, but they just need to know.
Yeah,
you know, they need to be told the truth. And as I used to always say to my ABC colleagues, you know, the audience has a great radar for bullshit.
Ooh,
they know when they're being fed PR lines. Now, look, before we wind up, and Trish, you know, I could go on talking to you for hours, but before we do wind up, there are two things that I do ask of leaders in this series. One is about ambition, we'll come to that, but the other is about failure. Have you failed, and if so, what did you learn from that?
Oh, goodness me, failure. Yes. Oh, gosh, yes. I'm just trying to think which failure to sort of think about, really.
I guess. Well, look, while you clock that over in your mind, I'll just add to that I always say, when I'm often asked to speak to students and or groups of young women about career and career success, et cetera, and I always say, you know, you cannot possibly have a great career without failure. You know, there is no such thing as an upward trajectory forever. You know, you have to ride a roller coaster if you're really going to have an exciting and great career. So I think failure is part of it. But yeah, have you experienced a particular failure that you've learned from?
Oh my goodness, yes. I think my two great failures probably came from working in an area where there was a complete clash of values, and not being able to keep my mouth shut, I think, in those areas. And I think that's where I learnt about alignment and how you have to work somewhere where you can be yourself and bring your whole self to work. Because if you can't, you become rogue and you are not effective and you're not a good leader. So for me, my failure has been thinking that I could contort myself into whatever culture or whatever organisation I needed to be with. And largely I can. I think most of us can. But it really taught me that when the values side of things is fundamentally misaligned, there is no way that you can be an effective leader. So that's probably what I learnt most.
I think that's fascinating, and there's a very, very good lesson in that for all of us. Just lastly, Trish, what would you tell your teenage self now about ambition and your future pathway into leadership, given what you know?
Gosh, get rid of the imposter syndrome earlier. look, and I don't say I've completely nobbled that one, but I think I carried with me such a sense of, oh, gosh, I'm an imposter here. Everybody else is smarter than me. Everybody else is, you know, all of these things. And quite honestly, that wasn't the case. So and that held me back. And I think I see a lot of women refreshingly, not so many young women. I'm seeing some just such a beautiful, wonderful, strong, assertive, authentic group of young women coming through, particularly in the public service at the moment, but elsewhere, you know, across society. So to me, if I could have said to myself, relax, just be yourself, keep going, and go for it. I think I honestly used to find 110 reasons not to apply for a leadership position rather than apply for it, other than by the end of the day I just thought, damn it, I want to do this. So, but it often took me a long time to admit to that.
Well, on that note, I'm going to close, but I think that's a really good way to close too, because what great advice. Just go for it.
Just go for it. Yeah.
It all works out in the end anyway.
Yep.
Trish, it's been such a delight to talk to you. And as I said, we could talk for hours, but I really appreciate you sharing, and so honestly too, your story. And thank you once again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So the old imposter syndrome rears its head again. I'm always staggered at how often people in senior roles privately admit to suffering from imposter syndrome. I've heard this so many times from highly accomplished and outwardly confident women. But guess what? I've only ever heard it from a man once. Which makes me wonder if it afflicts women more than men. What do you think? Have you found strategies to cope with imposter syndrome? I'd really love to hear your thoughts on that. You can connect with me on Twitter at Virginia_House, HAUSS, or find me on Facebook at Broad Talk, all one word. And join the Broad Talk Roundtable group, where you can check in with any comments or questions you'd like to share. There's always a seat for you at the Broad Talk Roundtable. Now, I'm taking a few weeks break and we'll be back with a new series of Broad Talk very soon, which I'm super excited about. So please keep a lookout. And thanks to the exceptional leaders we've spoken to over the course of this series for making the time to share their insights. I hope you've found them illuminating and helpful. I know I certainly have. And thanks to you, dear listener, for your support and encouragement. It's really meant a lot to me and the Broad Talk team. We love the fact that you're enjoying the series. Finally, thanks to the world's best podcast producer ever, Martin Pierce, a master whiz, without whom Broad Talk would never have made it into the world of pods. So until we meet again, thanks for your company, Broad Chatters, and keep talking.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.